理课堂听 class.com
Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. In advanced class today, we continue our journey to Brazil where we talk about saving the music tree. This is Doris Brom, Bong Meng Hui. Glad to be with you today. We had a friend visiting us who's living here now, who's from Brazil. We had Daniel with us in our class yesterday, didn't we?
Yes, and he told us a lot about Brazil.
Right. And today, of course, we have Esther. How are you today, Esther?
I'm doing great. It's good to be here. And today we'll be speaking again about the Pernambuco wood from Brazil.
And Ethan?
Hi, Doris. I'm glad to be here, too, and it's exciting always for me to get to talk to students about what our magazine features.
So open your magazine now if you have one. Do pages 10 and 11. We almost finished page 10 yesterday. When we found out about this music tree, but by the way, why do they call it a music tree?
Well, when I first read the article, I thought, well, maybe the wind in the branches makes a whistle or something. But actually, I learned that they use this tree in the making of violin and other stringed instrument bows.
Okay. The wood for this tree really does a lot for music. And we're going to hear a little bit more of violin music later, just so you can get the feel of the sound of the violin. And without this tree, it might not sound like that. So we're talking about the special kind of wood, but it's also got another name. And what is the other name besides this Pernambuco?
We also call it the Pau Brasil tree.
All right. And why does it have that name? Where did it get its name from?
This tree is from Brazil. It's actually the national tree of Brazil. And it's called this because it means furnace red wood. So Pernambuco also means Brazil wood.
And it's found in the coastal area in this certain state in Brazil that is named this. It's named after this, Pernambuco. That's the name of the area, just like we would say it's from a certain state or a certain province.
And this area is in the northern east part of Brazil.
Right. And it's a very thick wood or hard wood. It's like what? Woman de Quemo, something.
Yes. Kind of, it's very dense.
Very dense, mm-hmm. And it's called furnace red wood. Another word that Americans sometimes call it would be, it's called Brazil wood. It's certainly easier for us to remember than trying to remember Pernambuco.
Well, it definitely is. And one of the reasons we're featuring this article is we want to raise people's awareness about this tree. And one of the things we are looking at is that it's slowly becoming endangered, or it is slowly being cut down and there's less and less. We need to conserve them.
Well, when I thought about making violins, we're going to talk about this Stradivari violin or the Stradivari bow, and that's a very important part of the violin, the bow. But Stradivarius violins are the most famous, probably the most expensive ones there are in the world. Isn't that right?
That's right. And these are made by the Italian instrument maker Stradivari, who lived from 1644 to 1737. And these violins are made of very high quality, and they're very expensive. They have a very rich and nice tone.
They have very special wood, a special process. And the bows came from this kind of tree.
The bows do come from the Pernambuco, and as we'll find out in today's article, they are made by someone we say is the Stradivari of the bow. And so this François Xavier Tort was the highest caliber bow maker of his time, and so we compare him to Stradivari.
So we're going to find out who he was. You just mentioned his name, and what is his name again? He's a Frenchman.
Yes, and I believe it's pronounced François Xavier Tort.
I've always been very poor at pronouncing French words. What about you?
Me too. I only took 2 weeks of French and I stopped.
French is so hard to pronounce. It's much worse than English, isn't it?
Yes.
Because they don't pronounce things the same way we do, so it's hard for us. You know,
yes,
not
it
hard
is
for
very
them.
Difficult.
Right. So since it's an English lesson, we won't go into the French too much. But anyway, the bow makers share a common heritage. We often talk about people sharing a common heritage. What does that mean to you? Esther.
If someone shares a common heritage, they share the common background, often culture or traditions and language.
So this Frenchman from the 18th century, his name was Tort, we won't say his first name even, and he was an illiterate artisan. Now, artisans are people who are skilled at doing things usually with their hands, at making things, aren't they?
That's correct. And so he is an artisan who is skilled at making bows. His family was also bow makers.
But the fact that he was illiterate was not so uncommon in those days.
No, back in those days, in the 18th century, 1700s, many people were illiterate and they didn't have opportunities to attend school.
Actually, in the early 1900s, there were still a lot of illiterate people in the world. People couldn't afford much of an education. It cost too much, and they had to go out and work. When young men were sometimes even in junior high school age, they had to either help on the farm in China and countries like that, and in America, they also did that, or they had to help their father in the shop or the bookstore or whatever they were doing. They didn't have the chance to go to school.
Well, that's true, and during that time period, we saw that quite a bit, and so it's not surprising that for this Tort that he was this way, but I think his contribution to society was still very great.
So he learned a skill, even though he didn't learn to read and write, like we put a lot of emphasis on that in tests and everything, but he was very skilled in what he did. His skill wasn't with words, but it was with his hands.
Well, and as we look down, we see he had an apprenticeship when he was young as a clockmaker. And so he went and studied under probably a fairly well-known craftsman who made clocks and learned how to make clocks under him.
Right, and he was also an avid fisherman, which is pretty interesting. A fisherman. A fisherman uses what? Line, bow, when they go fishing?
Yeah.
So he was used to having fishing poles, right?
That's right. And I think because he was a fisherman, he probably knew a lot about wood and about bows and different things like that. So that's how perhaps he discovered this Pernambuco wood.
People who are really good fishermen, they know the difference if they have a good line that they could fish, a line and bow that they throw out, right?
Yes, he does. And I found it very interesting that he brought the skills from his fishing background and he brought the skills from his clockmaking experience into making bows.
I think we all do that in a way. Certain things that we learn, we can put them to other uses later on. So everything you learn is really important for you to use, isn't it?
Oh, it definitely is. I think of there are different times in my life where I've learned something, and maybe that thing won't come up again, but later on down the road, I'll see that, hey, this is a similar skill. I can use that.
Right.
And it's always good to learn more skills. The more skilled you are, then the more chances you have in the future.
Right. Well, shall we listen to this whole first section?
Sure.
Stradivari of the bow. Bow makers share a common heritage. An 18th century Frenchman named François Xavier Tort. Tort was an illiterate artisan and avid fisherman who brought skills to the bow trade he'd learned during his apprenticeship as a clockmaker. Tort brought a series of innovations to bow making, most his own, but some from others. His model was concave, with the wood bent into its shape over dry heat. It had a higher head than earlier bows to hold the horsehair away from the stick, a metal ring to press the hair into an even, flat band, and a screw mechanism to draw it to the desired tension for playing. Most important, Tort standardized every measurement of the bow, determining the optimum dimensions and weights, the precise curve and taper of the stick. His work earned him the honorable nickname Stradivari of the Bow.
So he brought these innovations, and an innovation is really a new way to do something, putting other things together. You innovate. You use something that exists and make something else out of it.
Well, and that's what we see Tort did, is he brought new revolutionary ideas in some cases to the bow. And I did some extra research outside of this, and I found that he went around and he took a bunch of different people's little ideas and compiled them all into what he thought would make the best bow, and that's still what we're using today.
Right. Most of them were his own ideas, but some he got from others. But that's the way that all knowledge is. It's not really new. It says sometimes there's nothing new under the sun. It's taking old things and putting them to new purposes.
That's right. We gather information from a lot of different sources, and it's when we can put these sources and come up with something new and creative. That's when we make a new invention.
Right. So his model was concave, and that's just a shape.
Yes, it is. We will hear this term often. We can talk about in glass lenses or in another type of lens, we will talk about a concave lens, and that just means it curves in instead of curving out, which we would say is a convex lens.
Okay. So concave turns in and convex turns out. Right?
I like to think of it as with concave caves in, and it's just a little trick to help remember it, which direction it bends.
Okay, and how do you remember turns out then?
Well, just convex is the other one, and so it's not the one that has the cave in it.
Okay. It's sometimes good to associate things, isn't it? Right. So it was shaped and bent over this, what they call dry heat. What is dry heat?
Dry heat is heat that is not, that does not have humidity.
And so oftentimes when they are making furniture and different things, they will use steam because it makes the wood flexible. But what it does is it also takes away some of the strength of the wood. And so what he used was this dry heat, and he could still move the bow and shape it to the form he wanted, but it still kept a lot of the strength.
Right. The moisture, of course, would make its shape easier, but it wouldn't be strong afterwards when the moisture was gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he had a very good idea of what made things work, and probably through working on some of those fishing bows in the past, right?
It did, yes.
All right. And so his had a higher head than the earlier bows, so they could hold the horse hair. Now, that's another interesting thing about bows. They're made with horse hair, really horse's hair.
Yes, and so when you pull it across, that is part of what helps to make the music is the horsehair bow. If you used other substances, it wouldn't be as nice a sound and probably not as durable either.
You know, when you listen to a violin, do you think about horse's hair? I don't.
No, I don't think about horse's hair. And I heard that they use 150 hairs for one bow.
So the poor horses, I hope they can grow it out fast again. But they do use very good horse hair for bows, and that makes them very strong and a good sound.
I also want to look at the term they use, the head of the bow. And if you look in the picture down to the right, that's the part you see is the knob that sticks up at the top of the bow that holds the horse hair away from the bow.
And this is also how you can tell the difference between different types of bows, is look at the head of the bow, and you'll see some of them are concave, some are convex. Sometimes they have different things on them, and this is how they're different.
Right. In fact, if you want to check the website, there's a website that has all these different kinds of bows you can look at, prices and everything. So it's fun to do a little extra on your own, right? Okay. So that it tells us here that it has to be drawn to a certain kind of tightness, too. They have to screw this thing in to make it just right for the right kind of tension, the right pull on it. So when you go across the strings, it doesn't go eek and make a screech, but it makes a beautiful sound.
Well, when Tort first started making bows, this wasn't something that was commonly done. They didn't have a good system in place to tighten this horsehair to the proper tightness. And so he made this metal ring that would help press it, the horsehair flat, and also to hold it out from the bow. And then he also added a knob you could turn that would tighten the horsehair to the desired taut.
So you look at the bows we have today, and there's always a knob at the end of the bow, and this is where you use to tighten the horsehair.
And you often see violinists when they're putting something on the horsehair, like we call the rosin on it, to pull across the strings easily. And then you see them tightening it. Did you do that when you had violin lessons?
Yes, when I learned violin for a year in fourth grade. First, before you take the violin, you have to tighten your bow, tighten the horsehair, and then put the rosin. And then you can start playing. And once you finish playing, you have to loosen the horsehair.
Right. You don't want to keep it tight all the time, but it might not keep that tightness, so you have to loosen it afterwards.
That's right.
So that's one of the things you had to learn when you were learning to play the violin. You don't think about all the things involved when you think of people playing those instruments. They just pick them up and play them, and you don't realize everything involved. Helps us appreciate it a little bit more. And every measurement that they had standardized made it easier for people to say, now this kind of strength or tightness will make this kind of sound. So it was necessary to standardize it, wasn't it?
Well, yes, it was. And at this time of the bow making, there was no standardization. It was just each bow maker had his own method of making it, and so each one would probably sound very different. But Tort came along and he said, if we want to make good sounding instruments, they need to be all the same. And so that's what he did, is he standardized, or he made everything all the same, of the measurements and the tightnesses that it should be used.
Well, I think we're going to be listening to a little tiny bit of some violin music, and then we're going to go right into reading Finding the Perfect Wood. But think about that as you just listen to a few seconds of this beautiful violin music.
Finding the Perfect Wood. Tort searched to find the perfect wood. His fishing trips along the Seine included visits to the wharves, where he scavenged wood. Only Pernambuco displayed the range of beneficial properties. In addition to its springiness, density, and strength, it was workable, readily adopting a curve when heated. Fortunately for bow makers of Tort's time, Pernambuco was readily available in Europe. Tailors coveted a red pigment in the wood, which was extracted and used for dyeing the robes of nobility. When the dye trade collapsed in the mid-1800s, bow making remained the only international industry still reliant on the Pau Brasil tree. By this time, however, Pernambuco supplies were becoming scarce. Even if the bow makers used relatively little wood, the tree they were using was disappearing.
So we realize now that this wood was already shipped around the world. It was already shipped to Europe and other places. And what did they use it for?
They used it for dye, for clothes for the nobility. So it had a red pigment and they'd use this.
I didn't really realize that. Did you know that before you read this article?
Well, no, I found it very interesting, but it also explains why they named it the furnace redwood.
Mm-hmm. That's true, because you could get a red dye out of it. So it had several uses, and he found this wood. He tried to find the perfect wood, so he searched around. And where did he go to try to find the wood?
On his fishing trips along the Seine, included visits to the wharves where he would scavenge for the wood.
What do we call people who go around and try to pick up things here and there?
We call them a scavenger. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when people do this for fun, they have a scavenger hunt.
Right. Have you ever been on a scavenger hunt?
Yes. I went on one when I was in high school. It was very fun. We had to go around Taichung and find different things from different places.
Right. You get a whole list of things, and you have to go and find them. They'll give you a clue. Then you check it off or show some reason. You mark your name on it or something. They call those a scavenger hunt. You look for this. You look for a certain kind of fruit on a certain tree or something like that. You just scavenge around. It means to look here and there for whatever you can find.
Yes, and so in this term, we're using it as a verb, and he's scavenging for the particular type of wood.
Well, for any kind of wood. He doesn't know what it is yet, but he's trying different kinds. So then he said, I'll try this wood and that wood, maybe different places, wood from different countries. And he found that only this certain kind, Pernambuco, had the kind of range or the different kind of beneficial things or properties, things that he need. Now, he needed a wood that was springy, that could spring back into place. It wasn't too tight, that it wouldn't break. He didn't need a brittle wood.
Well, and this is because he wanted to be able to shape it into the and bend it over this dry heat.
Okay. And he also needed one that has kind of a density. Now, some kind of wood either cracks or it breaks when the temperature changes. He needed one that was very tight, that was very dense, didn't he?
Yes. So, for example, balsa wood is a very light wood that I can even make indentations with. If I use my fingernail, I can press the wood and it will be nicked. And you couldn't use that for making bows, so you need something that is fairly hard.
And oak is an example of a type of wood that is very dense. And when something is very dense, it doesn't float in water, and the cells are very closely packed together.
Okay, so it had to be strong and all that. So he tried to look around. He didn't think oak was good enough, I guess, but he liked this one here. And he thought, this Pernambuco wood is really good, or this Brazilian wood is good. It's workable. And you could really curve it when it was heated. So it had a lot of the different qualities that he needed. And he did a lot of experimenting. So it shows that he had a very scientific mind. He was a very clever young man, wasn't he?
That's right. And he was also very skilled. Earlier we talked about how he was an apprentice for clockmaking, and also he fished a lot. So he learned these skills from these two trades he also could do.
Sounds like he had a lot of fun to me. Then fishing and trying this and doing that. What a life. You know, he didn't have to go work in an office building like people do nowadays. And he didn't have to sit in school and university and get a PhD. He just learned things by going out and doing them. That was the way people learned in those days.
Well, and it is a different type of lifestyle than we have today. In some ways, people think about it, and it would be nice to be able to do that. But in other times, I think about the benefits that we have in living in society now, and I think, well, it's just as good that I'm here.
Okay. It's better to be satisfied where you are now. But it is interesting to look back and see the way that people lived and the way they did things. But fortunately now for bow makers, in his time, and what was his time way back in 1600?
He was in the 18th century.
18th century,
was when
right.
He
came
in
later, 1700s then. 18th century. Well, fortunately for people, he did find this kind of wood, and he found he could get it easily in Europe. Now, where did the wood come from?
This wood came from Brazil, but they also shipped it to Europe that time for making dyes.
Right. It was available there, readily available. He could get it easily. And that's because the tailors just loved. They coveted this. They loved this wood.
Yes. If someone covets something, they desire it strongly. And so you can see that they really wanted to use this wood in making their dyes. And this was during the time where colonization was frequent in the southern hemisphere there in South America. And so this was how this dye was found out. And they were starting to say, well, let's bring this back and harvest it and use it in Europe.
And it was easy to get in those days. But then in the mid-1800s, the dye trade collapsed. That would be another whole subject as to why it collapsed. But they found other ways to dye clothes than the way they were extracting them from the trees, right?
Yes.
Chemicals and things.
And instead of using this Pernambuco wood for making dyes, it became used for making bows, and this became an international industry.
So then bow making became the only international industry that still relied on, still reliant on, that they needed, that was necessary.
Yes, and so the term reliant simply means it's dependent upon or it needs something to keep going.
Well, by the time people thought, oh, we really need this, then it became really just kind of a music tree in that sense, because the use then was mostly for making violin bows. Violins have always been a very popular instrument, and cellos and all of these stringed instruments that they have. And symphony orchestras have a lot of violins and cellists and string bass players, and so they all depended on this. But then what happened?
Well, the supplies became scarce, and that's because too many people use these. A lot of these trees were cut down, and earlier we learned that it takes about 30 years before a tree can be harvested and used for making bows.
And then they stopped importing it as much into Europe because people were no longer interested in using it for the dye trade, and so it was harder to find in Europe itself.
Okay, so then it was hard to find this. And they said the tree itself was disappearing. Now, that's not only because they were cutting it down. We're going to find out some of the other reasons. Probably we'll have to wait till tomorrow to find that out. But when they did decide this is the wood, it became very well known as the kind of wood needed to make a violin bow. Now, are those bows very expensive today?
Well, Esther quoted a price earlier that just shocked me, and I believe it was something around the vicinity of $3,200, which is just astounding for a small piece of wood like that.
That's the price that they start off at, and they go much higher. They can go into tens of thousands of U.S. dollars.
Just for the bow, not the violin.
Wow, I can't believe it. I can't imagine spending that much money, but for some people, I guess it's worth it.
Well, I guess if they're professionals and they make their living by that, it might be. I don't think that that's the kind Esther had when she was in grade school, though.
No, I probably had a very common kind.
But you might not have known the difference when you were that age, right?
No, and I don't think people need expensive instruments when they're just starting off.
Right. But it is nice to know what makes a tone different. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the main things that we want to remember from today's lesson? We're talking mainly today about the bow and the wood it comes from.
Well, and we focused a lot on this François Xavier Tort, and he was a man from France who developed this bow and revolutionized the way it was made by standardizing all the different measurements.
He was an illiterate artisan, and he liked to fish.
But, you know, I think people will always remember Stradivari, but I don't think too many people remember him. If you say Stradivari, they'll say, oh, yes, the famous violin maker. Do you think if you say, remember Tort? Tort who? They wouldn't know, probably.
Well, he definitely probably isn't as well known as the Stradivari is, but at the same time, I think he does deserve recognition because if it weren't for his new ideas brought into the bow making, then violins just wouldn't be what they are today.
And we might not like to listen to the music as much as we do today. So we really have him to thank for that. And everything that we do or that we hear or we listen to has so many things behind it that we don't realize. Even every radio program, you're hearing us now, but we have a technician, Marco, sitting in there. Hi, Marco. And if you didn't turn the dials, then you couldn't hear us. So everything, there's so many people involved in it. And that's what makes a beautiful program, a beautiful violin. Anything that's beautiful has more than one person involved in it usually.
Definitely, and I think we need to all remember to be thankful for what has happened behind the scenes so that different things can happen.
So let's have a little bit more of that beautiful violin music as we say goodbye for now. Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.